Hello and welcome to How Green is Your Deal, a podcast about Europe's path to climate neutrality. This podcast is part of Green Deal Net, a Jean Monnet network that brings together research and teaching on EU climate and sustainability governance. In today's episode, we are going to talk about climate activism and its impact on EU climate policies. If you listened to some of the previous episodes, you know that a lot of times guests like to mention climate activism as something that gives them hope for the future. So I'm very excited to be talking about this topic today and kind of exploring what activism actually is and how we should understand its impact. To help us do this, we are joined today by Louisa Parks, a professor at the University of Trento, whose research is focused on social movements and activism. She's also the lead author of the Green Deal Net policy options paper on the topic, which is linked in the show notes as usual. Hi, Louisa. It's really great to have you here with us today.
Thanks, Jana. It's nice to be here.
So in recent years, we've seen like a lot of climate activist activities, you know, like this climate youth protest, but also recently more disruptive acts like the soup throwing at the Mona Lisa, etc. When we talk about climate activism, like how can we really understand it? Like what does it all contain?
Okay. So, what I'll try and talk about is more the European context. And I think it's really important to make that clear because climate activism, environmental activism is global, but it can look very different in terms of what kind of activism unfolds in different parts of the world. And the impression, what jumps immediately into our brains, if you like, in Europe is right now exactly throwing soup at paintings and huge mass protests, etc. So I'm going to talk about what climate activism looks like in Europe right now. But I don't want it to come across as saying that's what climate activism is everywhere, because I'm really aware that the European view can be quite restricted in that sense. And actually, a really interesting part of European climate activism right now is also how hard it is to build bridges with activists elsewhere in the world. So in terms of European climate activism, at the moment, if we look at the literature, if we look at what people are writing about in terms of studies on social movements, we're seeing sort of three different streams of what we call extra-institutional activism. So we're not talking about the kind of advocacy that goes on inside institutions like the European Parliament or the European Commission. We're talking about, you know, the noisier, messier stuff that you might see in the streets. And pretty much we see trends of mass protest, which are kind of declining a little bit at the moment. Trends around disruptive activism, so precisely what you said about groups like Last Generation at the moment. And finally, slightly less visible kinds of activism, which are around sort of community creation and direct action to try and solve some of the bigger problems of the climate crisis.
Very interesting to have these three types. And I think it's also good, as you said in the beginning, to also really make this distinction that this is like the European case. And because, of course, we have a particular context that then I would assume enables some kind of activism as well that might be difficult, especially if we look at some other countries in the global south. When we think about these impacts of act, or when we think about these different types of activism, what are some of the direct or indirect impacts it can have?
Okay, so if we think more broadly about activism, and that's something we try to do in the paper that you mentioned in your introduction to the podcast, we try to think about what we know about how impact can flow from different kinds of activism, and how we can try to apply that to activism that's going on right now around climate change. So what we know from scholarship on social movements and on activism is that it's very difficult to prove direct impact. So, you know, the idea that, you know, I went out on a protest yesterday and today the policy will change, therefore the impact has come from that protest. And it's very, very rare that that kind of, you know, impact takes place. Most of the impact we see from activism is quite indirect in that sense. And that's because, you know, activism doesn't take place in a vacuum. It takes place in a complex social context. It's one voice amongst lots of different voices that are feeding into decision making. But it can still be a powerful driver of sort of long-term cultural change. So in terms of long-term changes, we see, you know, really important historical examples, like the first one that most people talk about are activism around things like universal suffrage. So, you know, votes for women. Is that the kind of change that would have taken place in a world if we imagine not having had that social movement unfold? So we see sort of these long-term kinds of changes, but then we can also zoom in on more targeted kinds of activism that talk about specific kinds of policies. And if we look at literature on how that kind of activism impacts on EU decision-making, we do have a little bit of evidence there as well, that combining activism that involves more people, sort of mass protests or slightly more disruptive protests, combined with advocacy within institutions, has caused particular changes or particularly shaped European Union decisions in the past. And in particular, decisions where the European Parliament is involved in, well, old co-decision or the ordinary legislative procedure, or we've seen shaping of even bigger decisions, things like the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership saw quite a lot of protest, and we've got some work showing how that was impacted, for example. Much more recently, we've seen impact of that kind, sort of combining a bit of protest and a bit of advocacy, let's say, around the nature restoration law as well.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's such a good point as well, that sometimes people, yeah, then do expect like this immediate like impact after a mass protest. And then when they don't see it, it can also lead to like disillusionment and everything. So it's good to kind of, I don't know, say again that, okay, there can be like this longer term impact, and we should really look at like the longer time that it is perhaps an impact on society or policymaking.
I think often we have a tendency to try and judge activism by the standards of advocacy or even of political parties. And it's not the same thing. They're not trying to do the same thing. They're not trying to make the same points or make very neat policy proposals. It's a different kind of function in the democratic balance, I guess.
No, for sure. If we zoom in a little bit more on like the aspect of EU climate policy making, when we look there at the history of EU climate or climate activism in the EU, do you see some kind of impact or link there between activism and EU climate policy?
Yeah, I mean, probably the biggest sort of broad claim about indirect impacts we can make is that the European Green Deal cites youth protests in particular as one of the reasons why it was, you know, put together, why it was seen as the right moment to forward the European Green Deal. So part of the kind of rhetoric around why we need a European Green Deal is that this is being asked for by the people, and look at all these protests that are unfolding. So that would be the kind of indirect broad impacts that's quite difficult to sort of prove empirically. But that kind of impact we can certainly talk about. In terms of more kind of precise sorts of impact, I mentioned really briefly there the nature restoration law. We've also seen, campaigning originally around the latest reform of the Common Agricultural Policy. On the other side of things, we're now seeing backtracking on some of that due to farmers' protests. So we need to also remember that other kinds of protest, with valid points to be raised, are also happening in the world. We also see, more diffuse impacts, again, that are harder to prove, but it's also harder to imagine how those those decisions would have come about, or those kinds of rhetorics would have come about, without the social activism in place. And that's around citizens' assemblies and sort of participatory democracy. So one thing in sort of media coverage of more disruptive activist groups that doesn't come out so much is quite a consistent call by those groups for participatory democratic decision-making on climate. And that's something that has always been talked about a lot by Extinction Rebellion, and more recently by groups like Last Generation. The EU is also talking a lot about this kind of participatory democracy, and in particular in relation to the climate, with the European Climate Pact, with sort of Ursula von der Leyen coming out and saying that she encourages sort of citizens' assemblies for the climate at member state level or at local level. This kind of talk, it's difficult to imagine coming about independent of any kind of push from activists.
I think that goes back to a point you were saying earlier as well, about that is all taking place in like a very complex social system, and that all these different actors, climate activism, but now also farmers, everyone somehow has their own role to play or their own function, and pushing for things to move into a certain direction. So I think that's really interesting to see that come back here. I think recently we've also seen a bit of a crackdown on climate activism in terms of like very high fines and bans and even jail time for some of the activisms. When we think about what the EU can do to still provide space for climate activists or other types of activism, what do you see that are some of the ways that it can do so?
So this is, this is an interesting one. I think the EU would have a duty there to make it clear that all kinds of different activisms, as long as they're peaceful, are actually a really important part of democracy and have always and long been part of how democracy has evolved in Europe and elsewhere in the world. Coming out and saying that you need to protect spaces for activism, I think, is a really important part of that. Obviously, it doesn't really have the competences to enforce that in such a direct way. But it is certainly interesting that in recent weeks, even the UN Special Rapporteur for Environmental Defenders has also, really criticised the UK's sort of treatment of climate protesters, including jail sentences recently. So what can the EU do more concretely, I guess, is also to think about how it's building or thinking about participatory spaces also at the EU level, because there are a few issues around that. And a lot of those issues are in a kind of tension between how activists think about participatory spaces like climate assemblies and how institutions then go about actually building them and carrying them out. And the tension there is often about things like who is involved and how are they invited. It's often around what is going to be talked about in this space. So often you'll get a critique of an institutionally built participatory mechanism because it already tells you what you're going to talk about and how. And that delimits what you can say to actually make bigger changes. I don't know, let me give you an example. Like if you have a participatory mechanism about a certain piece of policy, I don't know which piece of policy, let's say the nature restoration law, and you ask people, what do you think about this proposal here? And people can talk about that proposal, but that doesn't give them the space to say, I don't think this law is the right way of going about this at all. I think we should completely change what we're doing and take a totally different approach. So there's tension in how spaces are designed, what the agenda is in those spaces, and how much control the people who participate in those spaces then have about what is done with their deliberations, with what they've said. So ways that the European Union could start thinking about that is by building in more co-creation, by being really transparent about how it's going to use what comes out of those spaces in its decision making, and by really reaching out to some of those more excluded or marginalized voices in those spaces to give a little bit more confidence to those kinds of groups that it's worth taking part in those spaces, that they're not just talking shops that are there to make the EU look good, that they are really there to feed into actual decision making.
So then, if I understand it correctly, it's not only about creating these places of participation, but also really at the design of those spaces for participation includes more people to have a little bit more, like you said, a co-created initiative instead of the things that are perhaps happening now. Thank you for that. I think that's a really good point as well. So maybe to end today's episode, if you think about, what gives you like hope for the future, or if there's any like climate solution that you're excited about, something for our listeners as well, to end a bit on a positive note, because sometimes with this climate stuff, it can be a bit tough. So is there anything that you would say?
I mean, I think we've got, some spaces where we can, find some hope. I mean, if we're thinking about activism, just the continued existence and the continued kind of persistence of activism, I always think is quite hopeful, because it means that there are people who are still trying, right? So just, I think a few days ago, Last Generation have announced that they're changing now their strategy. Last Generation Germany are changing their strategy, that they're not going to glue themselves to streets anymore. They're going to move into mass disobedience kinds of actions, and they're going to target fossil fuel distribution networks and things like this. Now, you may agree or disagree with the kind of activism that's taking place here, but the continued kind of innovation and trying to think about how to achieve change and how to involve people in change, I think is a cause for hope. I think there's also cause for hope, even in the things that for climate activists might seem less encouraging on the face of things, like the farmers' protests. Those are, invitations to start having difficult conversations about how do we balance out these different needs? How do we keep farmers working and properly paid and fairly paid, while also trying to tackle climate change, which I think most organic farmers are absolutely in favour of doing? How do we really find those solutions? Well, it's a lot to do with having really good participatory spaces. And we've been experimenting with those for years, and we'll keep experimenting with them. And if we keep trying to build that reflexivity into those spaces, then maybe there's some hope to resolve some of those difficult situations.
Yeah, I think it's true. Like, one thing about people coming to the streets and doing this type of activities, it always shows as well that there is something left to fight for, like it's not all lost, like we can still push to do more. And then exactly as you said, some of these things can also offer ways to go into dialogue with each other and to reach out and to think about solutions together. So thank you very much for pointing that out as well on this activism side. And thank you so much for sharing all of your insights. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
That's it for this episode. If you enjoyed it, please subscribe to How Green Is Your Deal on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you are listening. If you want to stay informed on Green Deal Net's activities, please go to greendealnet.eu and subscribe to the newsletter.